Dream TV with Victor Thorne and Lisa Giuliani. The revolution is being televised.
Hello, it's Thursday, October 28th, and you're watching Wing TV. I'm Lisa Giuliani.
And I'm Victor Thorne. Welcome to Wing TV. This is day four of our American Free Press Week, and it seems like we just started yesterday, and we're almost already done with it. Mm-hmm. We've been very much looking forward to this show. We have Mr. Christopher Bolin, who's one of our favorite writers at the AFP. And it took a little bit of coordination to get this show together. Christopher was out in California yesterday. He's traveling by train. And right now he's between stops in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So, Christopher, we're glad you could fit us into Wing TV. How are you doing?
Welcome.
Thank you. Very good.
Well, we've been having different writers from the American Free Press on all week. And tomorrow we're going to finish with Michael Collins Piper. But we want to talk to you today about 9/11, and you were one of the first writers in the country, really, to start coming out and writing articles in opposition to the official mainstream media's version and the government's version of events. So tell us, what was the first thing that really struck you that something was awry in the whole 9/11 charade?
Well, I think the very first thing is that my family and I passed through New York City on 9/11 early in the morning. And so we were in the outskirts of New York and watched the events transpire at the World Trade Center and the second plane live. And as we watched it, my wife said right away, that doesn't look like a normal plane, as we saw the second tower get hit. And then we weren't able to go on to Washington because of the hit at the Pentagon.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I called up American Free Press and I said that there's kamikazes hitting the World Trade Center. And they didn't believe me at first, and then as we drove back across Pennsylvania, I thought about it and saw what a huge political coup this was for whoever pulled it off.
Uh-huh.
And the first things I started writing about was basically eyewitness evidence, eyewitness testimony of explosives in the building. And in the beginning, this was reported. Even in People magazine wrote about it on September 24th of 2001. And so using those sources, open sources, mainstream media sources, even the BBC, for example, they went on and on about explosions because one of their correspondents was in the South Tower.
Yeah.
Well, I think his name is Stephen Evans. He spoke about the series of explosions and the physical and human damage those explosions must have caused.
Yeah. Well, what happened in the sub-basement of the World Trade Center towers? Because you, I think, were the first person that wrote about these pools of molten steel that were in existence 7 stories below street level, and they were bubbling down there for 4 or 5 weeks afterwards.
Yeah, so right.
What
we
happened?
I spoke to Peter Tully, one of the four contractors that cleaned up the site. He's the only American company. His Peter Tully out of Bronx, New York, or Flushing, New York. Was the only American contractor, and he talked to me. He was willing to talk to me. He told me that they had discovered molten steel, still hot molten steel, which is about 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit. When they got down to the lowest basement level, this is where the central support columns, the 47 central support columns that held up the World Trade Center, where they met the bedrock of Manhattan. And then I spoke to Mark Loiseau of Controlled Demolition Incorporated in Baltimore. And he's the one who wrote the cleanup plan for the World Trade Center site. And he confirmed this, that 5 weeks, when they finally got down to that lower level, they found it. And what this is clear indication of, is that there was a very high energy explosion of some sort at that lowest level, and that the residual heat energy resided there in an oxygen-starved environment for 5 weeks.
Okay, now that brings me to my question. New York seismometers recorded these huge bursts of energy, which were shown as seismic spikes. So what does that lend credence to? The plane hitting the building?
When I asked the people at Doherty Labs about that, and then I checked with the University of California, Santa Cruz, where I studied, they said that those kinds of spikes are exactly the kind of spikes that you see when they do an atomic test, an underground atomic test. For example, in Nevada, you see a short, sharp spike.
Furthermore,
so when you take this high energy, high amount of heat that's residual down there, plus this spike, apparently some very powerful and high energy explosion occurred in the lower levels of the World Trade Center.
Also, can jet fuel even generate that kind of heat to make steel become molten?
Right. That's a very good point. You know, it would have had to be a very, very high energy explosive, And the thing is that it's possible that that the energy from the explosion was trapped under the bubble as it fell, which may be an explanation why that that the steel was in a molten state for so long. Or it could be that they used some sort of exotic micro nuclear weapon down there to devastate these support columns for the World Trade Center.
Now, the American Free Press, and specifically First Amendment Books, is distributing my book, 9/11 Exposed, which I quote you in quite a few times. And I received a letter yesterday from someone it was forwarded by the American Free Press to me, someone who had read this book, and they said, has anyone taken into consideration yet the amount of asbestos that was in the World Trade Center towers? It would have cost millions to get out.
Very good question. One of the things, I was at 911 out in New York a month ago or so, and a guy came up to me and said that for a year in the North Tower, he worked in the North Tower, he said for a year prior to 911, the elevator shafts would be, one or two elevator shafts would be closed for days, weeks, and months. So the thing is that in order to blow up those World Trade Centers like we see in the pictures and paper questions, a huge amount of explosives were put in the central column area. That's the center of the building where the support columns are and the elevators are. So I checked. There's two companies that do this kind of work in the United States, Controlled Demolition Incorporated, who I said, oversaw the cleanup.
Those who cleaned up Oklahoma City also,
yes,
right?
Right. The Loiseau Brothers of Baltimore. And then there's a company called LVI Services of New York, which is an asbestos abatement firm / demolition. So they do that. And Engineering News and Review wrote on September 13, 2001, that LVI Services had done extensive asbestos abatement work in the towers.
Huh.
So I called up the president of the company. His name is Burton Theodore Freed in New York. And it was amazing. I called up the company, and in 1 minute I'm speaking to the president. And I asked him about, I said, what kind of work did LVI Services do in the towers? And he said, we didn't do it. We didn't do it, he said. It was a company called AASI, he thought. And he says, but they're no longer in business. That's very odd.
How convenient.
So I asked him, are you saying that, Engineering News and Review, which is the construction journal of decades and decades of high reputation in the United States, is wrong? And to this date, I haven't gotten a confirmation from Engineering News and Review about their sources.
Mm-hmm.
But, you see, this is important because there were some Israeli guys that were caught in Weehawken, New Jersey, with Urban Moving Systems, I think it was called.
Right.
And they were seen videotaping the event from New Jersey. And the FBI arrested them, and they were held for 4 months, finally deported to Israel on visa violations. But what's important is that Urban Moving Systems vans all tested positive for explosives. Now, this is key, because when these guys got back to Israel, one of them was on the radio, and he told Israeli radio that they were there to document the event. And what's also important is that Forward newspaper, that's a Jewish newspaper out of New York, wrote that this company, Urban Moving Systems, was a Mossad front, and that three or four of these guys were actually Mossad agents.
And how would they
even know of
an event?
They were there to document the event, and two tests were done on their van, both tested positive for explosives.
Wow.
Now, I would definitely say that the head of that company, Dominic Suter, who ran to Israel like a day or 2 days after 911, he should be extradited to the United States and thoroughly interrogated.
Questioned, yeah.
What do you know about any possible direct energy weapon involvement in 9/11? I know some 9/11 researchers are tossing that around.
Right,
too.
Right. Well, I think I wrote an article about that in Germany, because I spoke to a scientist, a nuclear physicist over there, who talked about these weapons and how these weapons can be, used even from space. And, for example, infrared direct energy. And then what that would do is that could destroy a target on Earth. And I wrote an extensive article about it.
I
and
know.
Very interesting material. But, whether or not that kind of exotic weapon was used or not, I can't say. But what's clearly evident, for example, in the photographs in Eric Lipschmidt's book, Painful Questions, if you look at page 60, you see the North Tower coming down, and 20 stories below, you've seen the puffs of smoke coming
right.
out far
right.
below. But on page 60, you look there and you see explosions going off, three explosions going off, 20 or 30 floors below the collapsing level.
Hmm.
just like the firemen spoke about. Now, we all know that never before in the history of the world have steel buildings ever collapsed because of fire.
Right.
And that day, the morning of 9/11, after the planes hit, the firefighters were inside the buildings and they seemingly had things under control. There was no panic. They didn't say that things were out of control, while others were saying that they heard explosions. So, Christopher, what were they faced with that day once they were inside that building?
Well, when the firefighters got to the 78th floor of the South Tower, they reported that they had the fires were manageable and they were something they could handle, and they didn't report anything like the inferno that the official report is based on.
Uh-huh.
And this whole idea that this huge fire caused the metal trusses to fail is simply not true. I mean, the thing is that if you look at the photographs of the North and South Tower collapsing, you see steel and pulverized cement being thrust sideways 200, 300,
right.
400, even 500 feet. Now, as the towers got lower, the lateral thrust, the horizontal thrust of this material became even further. This indicates that the center, the core parts of the buildings had very high pressure. And that's important because when we see Building 7, like you said, all three buildings have fell, Tower 1, Tower 2, North and South, and then WTC 7, all belonged, basically, to Larry Silverstein.
Larry Silverstein, right.
Now, that's another individual I think should be questioned intensely.
Right.
I find it amiss that the New York press, for example, hasn't done extensive reporting on this man's background.
Oh, he's mm-hmm. slipped away completely.
But that's the case, and all three of Larry Silverstein's towers fell on the same day, an event that's never happened before in
that's
the,
right.
the world.
The
so,
coincidence
I mean, this
theory.
Is, we should be looking at this. But
right.
when you see WTC 7 come down, the 47th story, when that fell, there was no such lateral thrust. Nothing was being shot out of the side of the building.
It fell in its own
footprint. Straight down.
With regard to the Pentagon, we
yes.
find that highly suspicious, too. And we spoke with airline pilot Russ Wittenberg,
yes.
who has flown most of that fleet of aircraft. In fact, he flew the planes we saw destroyed on 9/11. He says that no 757 could perform the kind of maneuvers that are more indicative of a military jet aircraft as regards to the Pentagon.
Exactly. What I think happened there, some people think that it was a fighter jet, but I would say that the lack of very loud sound argues against that. And also the evidence. I presented this at the Los Angeles Grand Jury on Saturday. I was one of the five presenters of evidence. And I showed them, there's photographs from FEMA that show a very small engine turbine about 3 feet or 36 inches in diameter. Next to that piece of the jet engine is the housing and the insulation, and that is also about 3 feet in diameter. So that is proof that a small jet engine was found. At least one small jet engine was found at the Pentagon. Now, what's important about this is that my theory is that a Global Hawk, a weaponized remotely guided plane called the UAV, unmanned aerial vehicle,
uh-huh.
Global Hawk, which has one Rolls-Royce engine, which is 43 mm-hmm. inches in diameter at the opening, and has a very well-insulated housing to keep it quiet. It's a surveillance thing. I think one of those Global Hawks based in Ohio was weaponized and flew the path of Flight 77 to the Pentagon, did the fancy maneuver. This is all computerized. It's all remotely guided. It can do all these things. And it's got a 110-foot wingspan. It looks like a plane that would seat about 8 or 12 people,
uh-huh.
like some of the eyewitnesses reported seeing. And as it approached the Pentagon, it fired a missile, a small missile, that had a DU penetrator on it, which is a depleted uranium penetrator, which most American missiles have these days that are used to attack vehicles or buildings. And that DU penetrator went right through the building. Now, there's another evidence of this is that at the Pentagon, the Department of Defense was responsible for overseeing the cleanup. And I've posted lately in American Free Press and in other places these photographs from the Pentagon that show that they had extensive decontamination. They wore full body suits, they wore respirators, and they wore cutaway boots, and they went through extensive scrubbing after they came out of the Pentagon.
Very interesting.
This is a clear indication that the people of the Department of Defense were aware of some unusual contaminant not usually found. And these two pieces of evidence I presented to the grand jury, that's something other than a 757 at the Pentagon.
It's
important to remember that Boeing did put depleted uranium counterweights in the 747s, in the early 747s, but the 757 and 767 aircraft do not have depleted uranium counterweights.
Mm-hmm.
So if a 757 hit the Pentagon, the source of the DU or the source source of the contamination be something other than the plane.
Now, you asked before, you pondered a question why the New York media, really the world media in general, wasn't asking certain questions. How about that there's a lot of speculation, even proof, that at least seven of the hijackers are supposedly still alive? Why isn't anybody going to the Department of Defense or the Pentagon when they're given press conferences and saying, well, A, B, C, D, these people are still alive? How do you reckon with that?
Well, we have a very controlled press in this country, and it's not just the press that's controlled. The reporters are given the constraints, and they are, have to stay within those constraints. But over here in Los Angeles at the grand jury, Barbara Honegger gave evidence that the FAA officials have been given gag orders.
Uh-huh.
If they speak out about what occurred on that day or what they know, they'll lose their pension and face criminal action. Now, this kind of gag orders have been extended, I suppose, to everybody in the military and FAA and
firefighters
and ATF and FBI, you name it. So there's a lot of people that know what happened on that day, or they have big questions, and they can tell us something. But these gag orders are very effective, and the media operates in this country, unfortunately, like the controlled press of the former Soviet Union.
Right.
That's why
it's left to people like you and me to uncover these things.
Speaking of the media, Rupert Murdoch's name has come up in all of this. He put out a film in 2000 called The Lone Gunman, which had eerie similarities to what happened on 9/11. Talk about that a little bit.
Very eerie. Very eerie. This Lone Gunman, he made in March of 2000 in Vancouver, Canada, and the people at News Corp, Murdoch's company, told me that Rupert Murdoch, financed and produced the film. And this is a film where exactly such an event transpires, that a passenger aircraft is remotely controlled from the ground and flown into the World Trade Center. And at the very last minute, the editor, who's on the plane of a small populist paper like ours, tells the pilot, you're not controlling this plane. And then through hacking from another source, they're able to restore the manual control to the pilot and narrowly avert striking the World Trade Center. Hmm. And this stuff was filmed in Manhattan. They actually hired helicopters and flew at the World Trade Center to get this footage for this thing. And what's interesting is that Rupert Murdoch, he's originally from Australia.
Right.
And he is Jewish, and he's also a Zionist. He supports Israel. He is a close friend of Frank Lowy.
And Ariel Sharon, too.
Frank Lowy, who leased the retail space underneath the World Trade Center. And he's also a friend of Larry Silverstein, who got a 99-year lease on the towers.
Right.
Now, you have to ask yourself, this man just made a movie about a terrible terrorist attack on the World Trade Center. And his two friends, who he partners with in Zionist organizations in New York City, they share board seats on these organizations and things like that. They meet at conventions and fundraisers. That his two friends then go and lease that property and insure it to the hilt against precisely such an attack. And they also insure themselves for 99 years of projected income.
Wow.
And that, this is a very odd insurance policy these guys got. Mm-hmm. And then you have the U.S. Patriot Act, the so-called Patriot Act, which reimburses the insurance companies for the $7 billion that they're paying out for the destruction of the towers.
They didn't miss a beat, did they?
The 9/11 Commission members are tied to globalist groups and secret societies, yet the mainstream media doesn't report this stuff to the public. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, that's because the mainstream media belongs to the same secret societies.
Right.
95% of the work of intelligence agencies and secret services around the world is disinformation and deception. I mean, for example, this USA Today, I just got a free copy on the train, and they have a full-page ad telling us to buy a 911 commission report that this is, enough of these lies and conspiracy theories. You have to go out, and the government of Saudi Arabia and the United States have taken out this full-page ad.
Jeez.
And this is the amazing thing, is that the media in this country, many of the newspapers, are under direct CIA control.
Yeah. Well, that's the old Operation Mockingbird.
Yeah, and the thing is that most Americans are unaware of this, but many Americans get their news from the television, and the television in this country has failed miserably.
Exactly.
This is a case of extreme mass murder that occurred in broad daylight in New York City, and where are the books, the mass media, and the television reports that dig into the unanswered questions? You don't find them.
It's pure cowardice, is what it is. So, Christopher, we've examined now the World Trade Center towers, WTC 7, the Pentagon. How about Flight 93? I've heard reports from people in New York that actually heard, they worked at like mass media companies that said they heard reports that it was shot down, that Dick Cheney was the one that commanded it. What do you know about that?
And cell phone calls.
There were numerous reports that the plane was shot down. People were getting calls from relatives in the Air Force and things like that. We were in Shanksville. I was in Shanksville for about a week after September 11th this year. And everybody out there that I talked to thinks the plane was shot down.
Uh-huh.
It's a very small rural community. People are all related to each other. And like I spoke to Ernie Stolt, mayor of Shanksville, and he told he told a German television crew that when he got out there, his relatives were one of the first people out there at the crash site. He said there was no part of an airplane anywhere. Now, it's very interesting because, as I said, most people think the plane was shot down. When I went to the Somerset paper, that's the local town there,
uh-huh.
and asked, you know, well, what happened to the plane? Why is there no evidence of an airplane there? Now, mind you, the hole where the plane supposedly disappeared, this hole, is 5-6 feet deep and 20 feet wide. And into that hole, an entire 757 is said to have disappeared.
Right.
And what they tell me, what the guy that told me at the Somerset paper, who's also with the Air Force National Guard, you should know this, he told me that when the plane struck the ground, the ground acted like a liquid and swallowed the plane, nothing on the surface.
Very bizarre.
And yet, at the same time, he tells me that one wing and one engine bounced and flew something like 2,000 yards into the woods. And the man that did the excavation there, it belongs to a man in Svanovec. It was his former coal mine. He provided the equipment to dig up at that area where they did some digging. But only the FBI went into the woods to retrieve this engine. And you see, this is the thing. This kind of stuff is clear evidence that the plane was shot down. Furthermore, in Indian Lakes, which is about 3 miles away from the crash site, they found six trash bags full of mail.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, there's a lot of evidence. And like I said, the local people all say it was shot down. And another thing is that there's a half a dozen eyewitnesses there who saw a white plane, kind of like a Gulfstream 550, with wings that turn up, two mm-hmm. engines on the back, and a T-tail. They saw this plane before, circling the area, before anything happened, and then they heard this tremendous explosion, and then they saw that white plane circled, it was unmarked, it circled two times around the crash site and disappeared over the horizon.
You know, after listening to you, it means that nothing adds up in the official story. I mean, absolutely nothing is the way they perceive it.
Quickly, let me ask you about the cell phones. The cell phone calls.
Well, Flight 175 and Flight 111 landed. They flew out of Boston, and they crossed over Stewart Air Force Base in upstate New York. They landed there, and their flight paths were continued by military drones that looked like 767s or 757s. And those planes were weaponized. They had missile pods on the bottom, like in Dave Von Kleist's video shows.
Uh-huh.
And both of these planes carried, these missile pods carried a small depleted uranium-tipped missile, which is what causes the flash. If you look at both Flight 175 and Flight 11, the instant before the plane itself crashes into the building, there's a bright white flash. This is evidence of a depleted uranium missile striking the surface because it's pyrophoric, it's burning, and as soon as it touches, it inflames and makes a bright flash.
Yeah.
And there's evidence, we now have evidence that the depleted uranium penetrator flew through the South Tower. It didn't hit anything. It's very dense, and it's burning. And it flew through the South Tower ahead of the explosion, and it's photographed, for example, on page 39 of Eric Hirschman's book, Painful Questions.
Mm-hmm.
We have at least three photos that show this. It's burning white hot. It's a rod. It's burning white hot, not black, not brown, not... And it's leaving behind a trail of dirty colored oxides. And this is precisely, it's burning so hot that the oxides are forming behind it, like in the picture about a centimeter behind it.
Wow.
And it's burning white hot, whereas the flames in the tower are burning orangish and yellowish colors.
Yeah.
And this difference indicates that this object is burning extremely hot, much hotter than the explosion. And that's because a depleted uranium penetrator has kinetic energy, and when it strikes a building or something like that, its velocity is transferred into heat energy.
Well, Christopher, this has been absolutely fascinating. You've lived up to everything we expected and more.
We want to have you on again, Chris.
Well, we just want everyone out there, go to AmericanFreePress.net. You'll have one of the best reporters in the country right there, Christopher Bowman.
One of the only reporters in the country.
Right. But Christopher, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule. I know you have to get back on the train. So just keep up the great work. And
thank
this
you
has
so
been,
much.
Thank you very much, Victor. Thank you.
Fascinating.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Thanks.
Take care.
And tomorrow, folks, we'll be back with our final edition of the American Free Press Week with Michael Collins Piper. This one will be just as good as today. So thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Take care.